Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. President Obama used his executive authority under the United States Antiquities Act to create the world's largest marine protected area. He expanded the Papahanao Mokuakea Marine Park to include 500,000 square miles of waters in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. The designation more than quadruples the size of the existing marine monument, protecting pristine coral reefs, deep-sea marine habitats, and important ecological resources. According to NOAA, with this expansion, the United States now has some 1,200 marine protected areas covering 26% of marine waters. On the West Coast, long stretches of the Pacific Ocean have been turned into blue parks. And globally, we've seen more ocean protection in the past 18 months than during any other period in history. We have announcements of new marine reserves in the U.S., the U.K., New Zealand, Chile, Palau, and the Bahamas, according to Maui Now. But still, only 2% of the world's ocean is designated as highly protected. That's only 2%. And scientists say we need to protect 30% of the ocean to safeguard it for future generations. So why are marine sanctuaries so important? Well, one of today's guests, Robert Richman, says in an era of mounting climate change impacts on both global landscapes and seascapes, and with advances in technology that allow the exploitation of resources from the most isolated islands and deepest corners of the ocean, it is critical to protect resources of great scientific, cultural, and historic value. Robert Richman is director of the University of Hawaii at Manoa Kiwalo Marine Laboratory. He works in the area of marine conservation biology with a focus on coral reefs. And Robert Richman joins us from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. Good morning, and thanks so much for the invitation.
Good morning. Well, thank you for joining us. We're also joined by James Lindholm, professor of marine science and policy in the Division of Science and Environmental Policy at Cal State University, Monterey Bay. James' research interests include the landscape ecology of fishes and the design of marine protected areas. And James Lindholm joins us from Monterey. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So, Robert, I want to start off with you. This marine protected area in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands is very special. Most of us will never be lucky enough to visit the area, or maybe it is good that we can't visit the area, frankly. But I did watch a beautiful video from Pew, and just, it's teeming with life. This monument was originally created in 2006 by President George W. Bush and designated as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And since that time, there's been a lot of research there, lots of research looking at the connections between the monument and adjacent waters. Can you first off tell us about this place and why it is so special?
Yeah, well, certainly it's a magnificent area, and as a marine biologist, I can wax poetic about all the beautiful things that you'll find in the water, but it's far more than that. And what was interesting is the driving force, behind this whole effort was the Native Hawaiian community of cultural practitioners who view this as a seascape, meaning that it's not just the ocean, but it's everything associated with it, including the beautiful islands that are up there. That's part of the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, which are some of the oldest land masses associated with that region. And with the big islands still being produced by volcanic areas, these are the islands that, as moving over the hot spot, have been subsiding. And so we have atolls up there, very low islands and beautiful coral reefs. But far beyond that, the native Hawaiian community, the practitioners, including Nainoa Thompson, who's the both the lead, the head of the Polynesian Voyaging Society and the chief navigator for the Hokulea, which is the traditional sailing canoe for Hawaii, they recognize this as a very important place culturally. In Hawaii, there is a creation chant called the Kumulipo that refers to the coral polyp being one of the first living things on Earth and the ancestor of life. And this is all framed up in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. So especially within the Antiquities Act, it really identifies things that of scientific value but also of historical and cultural value. And that's why Papahanao Mokuakea is so special, that it really brings together the biological and the cultural in such a spectacular way. And for me, it truly was a privilege and an honor to work with the Native Hawaiian community on this, including the Office of Hawaii Hawaiian Affairs that's been elevated to full trustee status and being able to make decisions up there as kind of being a pet scientist to bring the science to bear in support of what have been identified as biocultural resources that integrate both the biology and the culture so seamlessly.
And this marine national monument will go from 442,000 square miles of protection to more than 582,000 square miles of protection. Again, it is now the world's largest marine protected area in the world. And as you mentioned, Native Hawaiians were instrumental in pushing for this expansion. The video that I mentioned that's at yourcallradio.org quotes a few Native Hawaiians. They talk about why this is so important. Can you talk about what went on behind the scenes and why did the Obama administration ultimately decide to expand this monument?
That was a lot that went on behind the scenes. I got pulled in probably about 6 to 7 months ago after the Native Hawaiian Seven, very highly respected Native Hawaiian cultural practitioners, had written a very strong letter to President Obama requesting that he consider expanding it from the present 50-mile circle around the islands to the full exclusive economic zone, the EEZ, which goes out to 200 miles. And following that, there are a couple of federal agencies, including the Council on Environmental Quality, CEQ, that does science advising for the White House. They were approached. That's when I had my first interaction. And initially, there was simply questions about, you know, why this area, why that size, and what kind of science was there to support it. So that's why I got pulled in. And there's no question that the science is overwhelming in terms of the spectacular resources. There was severe pushback, primarily by a group called WestPAC, the Western Pacific Fisheries Management Council, which is advisory to NOAA, and also the Hawaii Longline Fleet, which was pushing back against it. And it was a real battle, far more than a lot of us expected. And it was a battle that not only went on with facts, but a lot of representations and, frankly, misrepresentations by groups that said that, you know, this was destroying fisheries, destroying Hawaiian communities, destroying a lot of things, which wasn't true at all. So it became very much a bit more of a pitch battle than we would have thought. Again, my focus was on the science part, and when the argument was made that there was no science to support it, I and a number of my colleagues came together to be able to demonstrate the uniqueness of the site, the high diversity of habitats, the high diversity of organisms, the perfect location in a world of climate change. These are some of the northernmost coral reefs in the world, and outside they go into the temperate area outside of the tropics, and these are areas that are likely to do much better in a world of climate change where we see massive coral bleaching going on. We're now entering the third year in a row of coral bleaching. The 2014 and 2015 saw some of the most extensive and long-lasting coral bleaching events ever. For the Great Barrier Reef of Australia, the Northern Great Barrier Reef, 93% of the reefs up there surveyed had at least some bleaching occurring. So in trying to deal not only with what we have today, but looking to the future, a world of climate change, elevated water temperatures, and even movement of fish. As part of climate change, we see a warm pool expanding in the Western Pacific that's pushing pelagic fish to the north and to the east. So once again, this is a perfect area to not only be a recipient site for fish that are moving there and for larvae coming in from other parts of the ocean, but also being a source area that can feed the reproductive output back again. You know, we look at MPAs as kind of savings accounts. If you have enough principal in that account, you can generate an awful lot of interest that you can draw sustainably into the future. And so the location, the endemism is was mentioned, the things that are found there and nowhere else in the world. In the shallow water, the areas that were surveyed for the 7,000 species already identified, which is probably a fraction of what's really up there, 25% are endemic, meaning found only there. But when you go into the deeper water, that endemism goes up to nearly 100%. So on all cylinders, this thing is firing as one of the most important locations. Also because of cultural uses, again, as I mentioned before, the biocultural approach that the Western science and the traditional culture were in perfect harmony and alignment to show what a special place this is and why it was deserving of these protections. And the amount of pushback that came from, you know, a very small but very vocal group of people even surprised me. me, but in the end, I think the president and his advisors looked at the data, they looked at the issues, they looked at the benefit to not only the communities that are the cultural practitioners and as a set-aside for future generations, but the irony is the people who fought against this the most are the ones that will be among the primary beneficiaries because the fish that are produced in that area hopefully our colleague will talk more about it, but we talk about BFFs, and we're not talking about texting about your best friend forever, but big fat females, they really matter. And when you can get an area of protection with larger females, you double the size of a fish and you can increase her reproductive output anywhere from several hundred to a couple thousand fold. And what you're doing is basically telling someone, if you put $100 in your bank account, I'll give you 1% interest. And if you'll put $200 in, I'll give you, 500% to 2,000% interest. Who in their right mind wouldn't jump at that opportunity?
That is Robert Richmond, director of the University of Hawaii at Manoa's Kawalo Marine Laboratory. We're also joined by James Lindholm, professor of marine science and policy in the Division of Science and Environmental Policy at Cal State University, Monterey Bay. James, why don't you jump in here and talk about why this expansion is so significant?
I think Dr. Richmond covered a great deal of the territory, but I think from my vantage point, as one of the people who has yet to visit the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, it's exciting to me to think that we as a country are prepared to protect areas closer to home and those that are more distant. One of the things that's remarkable about this monument is it's really held in the interest of all the citizens of the United States and indeed the world, whether or not we travel to it or not. And I think that presents a unique challenge because frequently these types of designations are driven by local stakeholders. As Dr. Richmond mentioned, there was some pushback from the fishing community working in the vicinity, and that frequently is a story with marine protected areas around the world. And I always think it's exciting when we're able to look beyond the kind of transient short-term interest of stakeholders in favor of the long-term interest of those stakeholders and more. This monument is a monument to all of us. And, whether we ever visit there, it's still held in our interest. And I think for that reason, it's very exciting, in addition to all the scientific reasons Dr. Richmond already mentioned.
And in this case, it takes about 6 days by boat just to get to the furthest atoll. So most of us will never visit there. It's protected really by the sheer fact that people cannot get out there, but there is a lot of debris. Can you talk about the difference between marine parks that are accessible by humans and marine parks like this one that aren't?
Sure. I mean, historically, if you think back 300 years, the impact of humans was limited to where we could go. So fishing was constrained by how far you could row offshore in a single boat. And then increasingly sail allowed us to go farther out, and then the steam engine allowed us to go further out. And effectively now, we are able as humans to touch every dimension of every ecosystem on Earth. But what we have left are areas that are still relatively remote, like this one. You mentioned trash. The footprint of our plastics do reach out into the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, but for the most part, it's not close to any major population centers, and so it represents an area of the planet which we've yet to impact significantly relative to other areas, and hopefully it can remain, through this measure, protected ad infinitum. I mean, I think one of the ways, so Dr. Richmond mentioned a bank account. I mean, we think about these things as buffers against uncertainty. It is important to protect particular places against future impacts that we can't yet anticipate. Mm. It's critical that we understand the things that are happening now, but against this backdrop of climate change, other new technologies, it's really important that we have areas protected from any future use as well.
Dr. Richmond, can you elaborate on that? Because in the video about the Native Hawaiians calling for the protection of this marine park, one of the young women said that when her dad used to go fishing in Hawaii when she was a child, he would get an abundance of fish, 30 fish on a weekend, and now he's lucky if he gets one or two. And I love snorkeling, and so I try to go to Hawaii on a regular basis. And when I see fishermen, I ask them this question, and 10 times out of 10, they say the same thing. 15, 20 years ago, we had an abundance of fish, and now we're lucky if we catch one or two.
Yeah. First, I'd like to commend James. I think that the points he hit were just right on target, that this is such an important legacy for everyone in the world. This is not just for the local community or those people in the Pacific. And these are the kinds of bold moves you really need to ensure a future for our children and children to come. The woman you spoke of is Narissa Spies. She's a Native Hawaiian PhD student in my laboratory. Mm-hmm. And she grew up on the Big Island, and she was the favorite daughter who used to go fishing with her dad all the time, drive the boat, hold things for him, and be out there all the time. And to hear the passion and her own personal experience of what she saw going fishing with her dad, that, you know, the days when they were catching a fair amount in a short time, the fishing was dwindling. And as a commercial fisher at the time who was feeding his family and making money that way, you know, just to see the anguish of seeing things disappear before your very eyes. These are not future events we're talking about. These are things happening now. Same with climate change. And so the passion she brought to it, and she is what I call a triple threat. She's a brilliant scientist in the most cultural, in the modern Western sense, that she does great molecular work, and she's a phenomenal scientist. But she's also a very excellent cultural practitioner who grew up in Hawaiian culture, who speaks Hawaiian, who is, you know, integrated into the community and the culture. And she also comes from the generation that the two of us that, you know, are so concerned about these issues here today really feel that the decisions we make today are really going to be driving their future. And she comes from a generation that unfortunately is going to have to make up for a lot of the mess that us older folks contributed to by not necessarily being so effective. But it is a new day, and it's an opportunity to see people who have experienced the ups and the downs to recognize that ecosystems have built-in resilience as long as we keep things within a certain range. And that when you take the pressure off populations, you let the females get bigger, you increase the reproductive capacity, you set up these areas, these refuges. As James stated, it was, there's no place left on the face of the earth that can't be exploited, from the deepest ocean to the most isolated atoll in the world. And the only reserves we have are those that we choose by our own decisions to protect and to respect for the future. And again, that's where the culture part came in. Is it's a matter of respect, too, to say that we protect the things that we value the most. And having not only Narissa and her dad, but also the others, William Isla, who was the head of our Department of Land and Natural Resources in Hawaii. He's a very well-known fisherman and an active fisher. And for them to be able to say that, you know, if we do want there to be things left for the future, if we do want things for our children and grandchildren, we now have to take responsibility and start setting these areas aside. So to see the fishing community come together, and Isaac Harp, others who are long-term fishers, were the ones that were most vocal to say, we've seen what we had, we've seen what we've lost, and now we need to see what we can do to turn this back around.
And because of this expansion, James, it is now illegal to mine or fish commercially in this marine park. Again, it's almost four times the size of California. So this is a major, major change. Do these types of rules apply to all marine protected areas? You're not allowed to mine or fish in these areas?
Actually, they don't. That's a great question. I think so. The broadest term we're dealing with here is marine protected area. That's the most general term describing an area of the marine environment that has been closed off to some level of activity. But the types of activities that are protected vary widely around the world. You know, in California, we have a network of 124 relatively small marine reserves in which no fishing is allowed at all. They're non-extractive reserves. But then you also have, we have four national marine sanctuaries that are really managed for multiple use, allowing that there's some conservation, there's a conservation goal, but there's also a goal to reconcile protection of the natural world with human uses. So right adjacent to each other, you have two different, very different types of marine protected areas that offer very different types of protection. So a monument, like those that have been designated out in the Central Pacific, this being the most recent one, is a third category that have a different set of management tools associated with them. And I think, you know, another point to raise in this regard is that the designation is a huge and really important step, but it's not the end. It's really critical that we have both enforcement of whatever regulations are there, as well as long-term monitoring of these areas to really confirm that they're doing what we're asking them to do. you know, it's the getting a marine protected area designated is fantastic, but if it isn't performing the task over time, we need to know that. And the only way to do that is for regular, repeated monitoring of the organisms that occur in it. So we really, this is the point of departure for a long-term investment in that region, not an end in itself.
And is the term paper parks used to describe what you just said, that these parks are legally established, but there's no management in place? I've read that one of the struggles around the world is to get parks, the parks are legally designated, but they're not managed, so there's really no protection involved.
That's right. And I mean, that varies widely around the world. You know, some places are very well managed and well enforced, and others are not. Sometimes the enforcement seems to decline as you move further offshore. It's easier to enforce things that are closer. However, at the same time, you have the most human activity closer to shore, so you need more enforcement. So it's challenging. Yeah, the phenomenon of the paper park certainly applies to the marine environment. And the probably in addition to just encouraging more investment in terms of enforcement and science, the third leg of that stool would be to just encourage public education, because the more you can get the populace in support of the goals of the marine protected area, the better it will do. You really need investment from multiple different stakeholder groups in order to make it possible. And I think the exciting thing about this is there are many stakeholders rallied behind this new monument, which hopefully will increase the probability of its success in achieving its goals.
And Robert, what would you add to that?
Yeah, again, James hit it right on target. And by the way, I prefer to go by Bob. I keep hearing Dr.
Richmond. Okay.
Looking around who people are talking about. In any case, yeah, that, you know, having something, it's a step forward, but I think James said it very eloquently, it's a step in a process. And without, you know, the hope is that you get compliance, and that is people who buy into it and recognize the value. And again, I fully agree that education is such an important part of it, is to get people realize that how much more they have to benefit if it's done right. And rather than having to put a lot of resources into enforcement, which is often absolutely required, a colleague of mine at NOAA who, you know, deals on the enforcement side has a great philosophy to say, you know, every time we make an arrest, every time we do a confiscation, every time we have a major bust, I consider it a failure because it never should have gotten there. That the hope is that through compliance, you can get people to buy in and actually be a big part of the solution rather than the problem. And it's a huge area. But, you know, the good news is that the technology has changed dramatically from the days where it was kind of, you know, hide and go seek, where the poachers would be there trying to dodge. In this area, there's already requirement for what's called VMS, the vessel monitoring systems, that enable them to be tracked using radio, satellite imagery, satellite data, and others. But satellite imagery is so good now, we know about it from military applications, that you can actually track a single fishing vessel by its wake signature. You can. There are underwater hydrophones that are used for a variety of purposes, not only for whales and marine mammals, but also can be used to track other underwater activity. And between the modern technology, the satellite imagery, being able to use the hydrophones, being able to use other technologies that are coming online as part of something that was called Sea Scout, but I guess the Boy Scouts were pushing back, so they changed the name. I forget exactly what the new acronym is. But it's between the State Department and the Coast Guard, the Navy, coming together to bring technology to bear to be able to do the surveillance that James talked about to help with the monitoring to see what the activity is up there. And actually, the expanded border from the 50 to the 200 mile makes it easier for enforcement from those that we used to call the dash and crash that would zip in quickly, see what they could get, and get outside of the 50-mile limit again before anybody could detect them. With this 200-mile buffer now, it does put in much better protection for the area. On the science side, there's also some very exciting things. Part of the worldwide effort to be able to have sustainable fisheries is addressing what's called IUU, illegal, unregulated, unreported fisheries. And now, as part of the legislation that's going on internationally, is that you don't necessarily need to find whale blubber or a baleen or the carcass or the shell of an endangered species like a turtle on board a vessel to have an enforcement. There's something called eDNA that stands for environmental DNA, where you can actually just take a small water sample from the bilge of the fishing boat and you can tell everything that was in there. So if you can get the whale DNA, turtle DNA, you can actually use that for an enforcement as well. So again, you know, echoing what James said, that paper parks It's a step in the right direction to get the declaration, but now the heavy lifting starts in terms of the enforcement, in terms of the monitoring, and a very big part of MPAs, Marine Protected Areas and Sanctuaries, is to really identify what the goals are. Are the goals to be able to bring stocks back again? Is it to protect a particular area, particular species? In order to answer that question, you do need additional monitoring, and there's hope that resources will be available to follow up on all the things that James clearly identified as important.
Bob Richmond is director of the University of Hawaii at Manoa's Kiwalo Marine Laboratory. He works in the area of marine conservation biology with a focus on coral reefs. And James Lindholm is professor of marine science and policy in the Division of Science and Environmental Policy at Cal State University, Monterey Bay. Today we are talking about the importance of protecting our oceans and the importance of marine protected areas. Last month, President Obama expanded the Papahanao Mokuakea Marine Park to include 500,000 square miles of waters in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. This is now the largest marine protected area in the world. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m.
On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about reproductive rights in the United States and around the world. More than 60% of the world's population live in countries where there are abortion restrictions. This year in the United States, 14 states passed more than 30 laws to make it harder to get an abortion. How do American laws compare with international abortion regulations? Send your question to feedback@yourcallradio.org and join us live at 10 a.m. with Rose Aguilar and you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking with scientists about the importance of protecting our oceans and creating marine protected areas. You may have heard that President Obama expanded the Papahanao Mokuakea Marine Park in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. We have a really great video from Pew, P-E-W, on our website, yourcallradio.org. This is a special place. It is so beautiful, teeming with life. A number of Native Hawaiians are in the video talking about why this is so important. And we're talking about it with Bob Richmond, director of the University of Hawaii at Manoa's Kiwalo Marine Laboratory, and James Lindholm, professor of marine science at Cal State University, Monterey Bay. And if you'd like to join us, if you'd like to talk about marine protected areas, if you have any questions about this, we are lucky to have these in California. So much of our coast is protected. If you work on this issue, we'd love to hear from you. There's a lot of good news out there, but the fact is only 2% of the world's ocean is designated as highly protected. Only 2%. Scientists say we need to get that number up to 30% to truly safeguard it for future generations. You can give us a call at 86- You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. or leave a comment on our website. We have an email from Janelle who says the expansion of this marine reserve gives hope to all of us, a relief to the almost unending grief we experience looking at our natural losses. Thank you to every person involved in making this so. Thank you for that email, Janelle. And let's hear from Marie-Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, Marie-Louise. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. Good morning. So, Ford, what I wanted to say is we have to go either far, far west or far east. And that is that I heard recently on a radio program, I believe, that some Chinese fishermen are blowing up huge pieces of coral in order to get to clams that can weigh up to 300 pounds, and they will give them a huge amount of money. Mm. And it was so painful to hear this, I almost feel it in my bones, you know. So I'm awfully glad for this, what's happened in Hawaii, but I would like to just keep pointing this out because I don't know how to do anything about it. But just for people to know, I think is so important. Imagine where we try to save the coral and they just make it explode.
Yeah, well, thank you. James, do you want to take that one first? Can you tell us about that, how that works?
Well, I think I'm not as familiar with that specific story, but there clearly are a lot of fishing practices around the world that are destructive, not only of the organisms that are targeted for extraction, but for other attributes of the environment that are damaged when you're seeking that particular animal. So it does, if you're pursuing a fish or a particular invertebrate from a particular environment, you have to realize the environmental context in which that fish was produced. So coral reefs are very productive with respect to a whole variety of marine organisms. And if you damage the reef in pursuit of a fish, you damage that reef's ability to produce those very fish at future years. So these marine protected areas give us an opportunity to protect us from our own short-sightedness, which I think is hugely valuable.
And Bob, what would you add to that? How common is dynamite fishing or blast fishing?
Far too common. So as James said, there's just a larger category of destructive fishing practices. Certainly dynamite is one of them. Cyanide fishing, where people use sodium cyanide to squeeze into the crevices of a reef to get aquarium fish out. We consider when you're fishing is called bycatch, but in a way, this is also destruction of other resources that are essential to the ecosystem function. And as James mentioned, you're actually destroying the very habitat, the very home in which these things exist. The caller is correct. I'm unfortunately too familiar with what she said because I just came back from Palau, Marshall Islands, and other work in the Federated States of Micronesia. And there are fishing boats coming out of Asia that are poaching the large giant clams. Mm-hmm. They're using them now for carvings in addition to the meat. And again, these things that can take 40, 50, 100 years to grow are destroyed quickly. And once you start to hit the populations like that and you separate out the distance between these non-moving animals, unlike fish, they can't aggregate to spawn. They depend on a density in their own area to be able to go. And you can take populations from, thriving to decimated in no time at all. And this is something that has been part of the discussion with our colleagues in the Pacific Islands. And I think it's something that refers back to what James talked about, that when Papanamo-Kaeakea was set aside, it's not just for the United States or for Hawaii, it's for the world. The connectivity really does matter. And, there's upstream, downstream. If you start hitting areas that are upstream that are feeding other reefs or other parts of the world, it can have a long-lasting effect to other areas that should be getting their larvae, their seed from these areas as well. So destructive fishing practices in many areas, it's improving. The Philippines, through a lot of local community action, has really pulled back on that. Same thing in Indonesia. A very interesting paper written by a social scientist and some of his colleagues about bright spots in the ocean and what makes certain areas, even those that are close to human populations, in better shape than they should be, at least in terms of fisheries and environment, and other areas that are fairly isolated are actually in worse shape than one would expect based on their relative isolation from human populations, but not from climate change. A lot of it had to do with the ability of communities to self-enforce, to self-police, and to basically ban any of the destructive fishing practices, and also to be able to go back to the compliance that both James and I talked about of being able to be good stewards and owners of the resource. And we see that within the Pacific Islands. Those that are being hit by the poachers from other areas, generally these populations recognize that this is their own future, and they do serve as very good stewards of the resource. It's particularly damaging when you have others that come in, just get as much as they can, and leave again. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, why Papanamo-Kaeakea is such a great opportunity at such a great time. As everybody reflected, there's not a whole lot of great news coming out of the ocean these days with climate change and overfishing, pollution, and all the other things. And having moments like this where people can look back and say that this was a step on the numbers game, we now have to say it's not 2%. Now it's approaching 3% because of Papanamo-Kaeakea.
Oh, wow.
And for those of us that were involved in it, we're actually looking forward to the day when it won't be the largest marine protected area in the world anymore because some other group will come up with something even bigger.
And I just have to ask, when you're talking about these giant clams, are you talking about the ones that are just so beautiful, deep purples, deep blues, deep greens, those clams?
Yeah, this is Tridactyna gigas, the giant clam that of lore. They used to call them killer clams, but they don't kill people. You don't stick your foot in and get stuck. I've never seen anybody do that in 42 years of working on coral reefs. But they have exquisite colors because, like corals, they are a symbiotic organism. You've got the animal, which is the clam part, but they're full of these beautiful single-celled algae that are power plants. They're basically solar-powered, and you get beautiful turquoises and blues and greens and browns, and they're spectacular creatures to see in life.
I'll never forget the first time I saw them. And you can go to Google Images and type in giant clams. I'm looking at a dozen, at least, gorgeous photos of these giant clams. And Marie-Louise, we found an article at National Geographic called Giant Clam Poaching Wipes Out Reefs in South China Sea. And we will add a link to yourcallradio.org. So thank you so much for calling in with that question. Let's go next to Bill in Mountain View. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call. I have a question for your guests about ocean algae, and I know that it's under basically siege from climate change-related things, warmer water and also more acid water, and yet it would seem, based on my reading, to be a secondary tipping point after losing the Arctic for methane outgassing, that the ocean algae, which takes three-quarters of all the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, if it's under siege, we really have a decrease in our ability to clean up the atmosphere. So can your guests speak a little bit to what the status of that is, not necessarily from a scientific point of view, but from the point of view of what can we do, for example, before Obama terms out? Is there a magic wand he can wave that would help on that?
Thank you. James, do you want to take that and explain ocean algae to us?
Right. So I think that much of the carbon sequestration and consequent O2 production results from algae in the ocean. This is at the thin upper layer of the surface waters that cover 71% of the planet. I think that, and then there are extremely productive algae also in coastal zones, zones of upwelling like those along the state here in California. I think that engineering a response to that out in the open sea is going to be very difficult, and probably the best thing we can do is embrace these kind of global climate accords that are focused on reducing CO2 emissions as quickly as possible. You know, there are a number of scientists who've explored options for instance, introducing iron into the upper reaches of the surface waters to stimulate phytoplankton growth and the associated benefits of their presence. But to date, it's really transient because those things, they live a very short period of time, they die, and then they sink out of those surface waters. So engineering a response out in the open ocean, at least in the near term, is probably going to be difficult. But if we can, you know, work to minimize CO2 emissions, I think that in the near term is the best thing we can do.
And Bob, what would you add?
Yeah, I'm certainly on board with everything that James just said as well. In terms of Obama waving his magic wand, I don't think there's a whole lot that he can do in his remaining few months. But it is an election year. And, you know, I was just going through some of the recent statistics that 72% of the Republicans in the House of Representatives and Congress are climate change deniers. So it's not Obama's magic wand we need to wave. It's the electorate's magic wand. There is now a Republican caucus in the House on climate change of people who recognize this as being an issue. That's that other 28%. So without trying to be partisan, it's for the American people and the people of the world to put people in these decision-making positions that are going to do exactly what James says. We've got to be able to curb greenhouse emissions. We've got to be able to slow the trajectory by which climate change is affecting ocean chemistry, the distribution of everything from algae to apex predators and pelagic fishes. And that decision is within our hands. I believe that the window is still open. And we had a recent coral reef symposium a couple of months ago where the consensus was the urgency is there, but there's still a window of opportunity, but that window's closing. And this is a key election as far as we're all concerned, that if we get people in that will act responsibly and start to be able to push things in the direction of reining in climate change, then I think we do have a chance to be able to reverse some of the very concerning trends we see at the moment.
Bob Richmond is director of the University of Hawaii at Manoa's Kualoa Marine Laboratory. James Lindholm is professor of marine science and policy in the Division of Science and Environmental Policy at Cal State University, Monterey Bay. Today we are talking about the importance of protecting our oceans. We're talking about marine protected areas. Last month, President Obama expanded the Papahanao Mokuakea Marine Park to include 500,000 square miles of waters in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. It is now the world's largest marine protected area in the world. And if you'd like to see how beautiful it is and also hear interviews with Native Hawaiians and also Bob is in the video, you can go to yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us to talk about the importance of protecting the oceans, if you have any questions about this, if you work in this area, we'd love to hear from you. 866- You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. We've got 124 small marine reserves and four sanctuaries. A lot of our California coast, luckily, is protected. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. I guess a question I have is related to a conversation that I heard on a panel discussion on KPFA a couple days ago where someone by the name of Roy Scranton was talking about this very subject, and he cited some statistics that were very alarming, I mean, with regard to the rise in sea levels and what's happening with the climate. And I guess what my concern is, and I think it partly was addressed by your last guest, is I don't understand why, given the dire consequences of not moving on global warming and climate change and how it relates to the issue that you're talking about, the coral reefs, why it is that we seem to be living in a country that's in denial, a world that seems to be in denial. I mean, this should be the number one topic blaring from every radio, whatever, TV screen or whatever, and I can't figure out why people just seem to be slumbering about this thing. I know that there are people who are working on this. It's a big movement around the world. But, I mean, if this doesn't get solved, this is going to be a nightmare.
Well, hopefully it'll get more attention in the national media after the election. But the fact is, Bob, I don't really even hear the candidates really talking about climate change.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate, and your caller is right on target again. I mean, these are the data that people, that James, like James and myself, look at almost daily. And, you know, the concern is we're looking at people who are letting a false ideology trump reality. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go very far to look anywhere any longer. And it's that urgency that, you know, a lot of scientists have been going over what it is that we're doing wrong in terms of both messaging and, in some cases, it's the messenger. There are some people, their ideology refuses to take good science. You have people out there, for whatever reason, that are still arguing against a lot of things. You know, I put them in the same area with the flat earthers that, you know, I tell them, you know, the earth is not flat and climate change is not a hoax. But hearing it from a scientist is not going to change their point of view. So it's not just the messaging. I think the scientific community is doing a better job, but it's being able to team up with others. The economists are now coming on strong. And for people who don't want to hear science and data are not going to change their minds whatsoever, when they recognize that if they live in Florida, they're not going to be able to get property insurance because the actuaries are looking at the data and saying no way, that they're going to have to depend on FEMA and other government programs to be able to provide homeowners insurance. You know, Marco Rubio was a presidential candidate, and he's talking that climate change is a hoax, and here there's seawater coming up through the manhole covers in South Beach at high tide and trying to say that it's not happening. You know, this idea that it's not happening, I think more and more people are realizing, from the heat waves and the droughts in the Midwest to the climate change driven sea level rise, this is not a future event. It's happening today. And I think it's a partnership now when the work that we do, not only are there 31 U.S. scientific organizations that have written a very strong letter to Congress, but now we're getting the military is certainly taking climate change into all their planning. We have the insurance companies. Now even the American Medical Association has a link on their website about the impacts of climate change on human health. this is something we need to convince people that it's real, it's here, and it's not a kind of abstract idea. It's something that will affect their lives more and more every year that goes by, and certainly anyone who can understand the value of life insurance to protect their family members against catastrophic problems in the future. Anyone who can buy life insurance should definitely be recognizing that climate change and addressing it is one of the most important things to do for the future.
Well, thank you for calling in, Greg, and we are committed to covering this issue. It's another reason to support independent media, frankly. Bob, you have said that nothing can escape climate change right now. Going back to the importance of these parks, can you talk about what happens when we leave an ecosystem alone? So, for example, this park in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, almost four times the size of California, what happens when we just leave it alone?
Yeah, well, the issue is multiple stressors and what we call the cumulative impacts, that you can address each stressor individually and still lose in the end. And so it's the holistic health of the ecosystem that's really critical to a term that a lot of us are familiar with called resilience, that people understand it from just common, you know, this person is resilient, that if you have an individual that's in pretty good health, you know, their kidneys are functioning well, that they have a good circulatory system, they can get sick and they'll recover from it fairly quickly. If you have an individual that has compromised systems, their kidneys, their liver, they're drinking a lot, they're smoking a lot, they get sick and recovery doesn't happen, or elderly people whose immune systems are compromised. So human health and environmental health are completely compatible when we discuss these kinds of things. As you add stressors, everything from water quality, sedimentation, pollution in areas near coastal areas, those that are further away that are being affected by climate change. You know, my recent work in Palau, they're not generating CO2. They're not the ones that are causing it, but their reefs in Palau have not been able to escape it. Mm-hmm. 1998, we did surveys down there. 30% of the corals in the Palauan archipelago died within a couple of months because of something that they were distant from and were not contributing to, but they're not able to escape being part of the Earth. So I think this view that having these areas that are removed from local sources of stress enhances their resilience to be able to deal with these stressors that are happening at the global level. And that's one of the key approaches and one of the reasons, again, why the expansion of Papanaumokuakea is so important, is setting aside these areas that can serve as repositories, areas where things are reduced, that are more isolated, as James talked about before, from the daily impacts of human existence, and are more resilient, able to come back from these hopefully more acute disturbances. Unfortunately, climate change is going from the acute category to more chronic, and that's a signal that we definitely need to address. But isolated areas, in fact, do enhance resilience, and as you begin to reduce local stressors, even around human populations, you do impact the ability of these to come back from stressors.
And James, earlier you mentioned that we have 124 small marine reserves in California. We have four sanctuaries. Can you talk about some of the changes we've seen here in California as a result?
Yeah, and I think to the original premise of your question, I think, you know, personally, I think it's really important to emphasize the element of marine protected areas that leave nature, quote, alone to its own devices, as opposed to our interjecting and trying to restore the system actively these systems are extremely complex. And when we try to restore things, frequently some of our humanity's biggest mistakes have been trying to restore systems we don't fully understand, and that all kinds of unintended consequences. So by closing off an area and letting nature do what nature does well, will not always bring the system back on a trajectory that we know, but at least it's a natural trajectory. And I think that enhances this term that Bob mentioned, resilience of the ecosystem. So here in California, our network of 124 state marine reserves and conservation areas is all relatively new, designated within the last 5 years, with the exception of four or five spots up and down the coast that have been in place for more than 20 years. Places that some of your callers or listeners might know, like Point Lobos Marine Reserve, which is here down on the southern end of the Monterey Peninsula, or La Jolla Cove down in San Diego. These areas were closed for a long time, and what you see in these areas frequently are larger fish and more fish, more individuals of individual species, and more species. And then to relate to this term, Bob used before, BOF, you know, we know that the bigger females produce not only more propagules, more eggs, but each egg is more robust than the younger females. So the bigger the fish we are, the more fish there are, the better these reserves are serving to perpetuate those species in the areas where they occur. And an interesting thing, too, is despite the fact that we get a great deal of stakeholder pushback about the designation of reserves, if you use the technology that Bob was alluding to earlier, satellite technology, GPS, we can track where fishing activity goes fairly accurately. And one of the things that's interesting to see is that the fishing activity is frequently clustered along the line around these marine protected areas. It's the phenomenon known as fishing the line, which suggests that stakeholders, though some of them, though opposed to the idea in principle, recognize that these sometimes small, sometimes large reserves are actually going to serve to improve the numbers and size of animals immediately adjacent to them. So they choose those areas to fish.
I think we need to do a show about fishing because we have a couple emails and we don't have time to get to them. We did a show recently, actually, about fishes feeling pain, their personalities. Such a great, great book about that. You can find that at yourcallradio.org. Bob, final thoughts from you. Right now, almost 3%, thanks to this designation, of the ocean is protected, but we need to get to 30%. It seems like we are now on, hopefully, a fast trend to create these marine protected areas with the management in place. Again, we have announcements just in the last 18 months from Palau, Chile, New Zealand, the UK, the US. About a minute left. What should we expect in, say, the coming years? What would you like to see?
Yeah, well, I certainly commend President Obama by leading by example. It's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to do it. Palau just set aside 80% of their EEZ into full protection, and that calculates out to 36 square kilometers for every Palauan on the face of the earth. Yeah. Even though we have the largest, it's 0.005 square kilometers per American, but still, it's huge. And I think that's the goal. And the idea just coming from the World Conservation Congress in Hawaii, a resolution passed overwhelmingly to set the goal of 30% of the ocean in protection by the year 2030. So I remain optimistic that this is realistic and it is the way of the future. And I think more and more stakeholders, and as James said, through education and through programs like yours, build the political will to make this happen.
Bob Richmond is director of the University of Hawaii at Manoa Kalaua Marine Laboratory. James Lindholm is professor of marine sciences at Cal State University, Monterey Bay. Bob and James, thank you so much for all of your work on this issue, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having us.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. Be sure to watch that video, yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar, and it's Your Call.
On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about reproductive rights in the United States and around the world. More than 60% of the world's population live in countries where there are abortion restrictions. This year in the United States, 14 states passed more than 30 laws to make it harder to get an abortion. How do American laws compare with international abortion regulations? Send your question to feedback at yourcallradio.org and join us live at 10 a.m. with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Helena Murphy is our intern and researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.